Hi, I'm Sharad Fitton, and welcome to Consider This, the show that makes you consider and reconsider the news of the day. The recent escape of hundreds of detainees from the Sungai Bakap Immigration Detention Depot has again put the spotlight on the place and treatment of refugees in the country, in particular the Rohingya community, who come from the Rakhine State, part of Myanmar, based on the western border with Bangladesh. To understand better, not just the Rohingya, but also the larger problem of refugees, we have Gerhard Hofstadter, Associate Professor, School of Social Sciences, at University of Queensland, the author of numerous studies on migrants in Malaysia, also the author of Modern Muslim Identities, Negotiating Religion and Ethnicity in Malaysia, as well as Urban Refugees, Challenges in Protection, Services, and Policy. Gerhard, thank you so much for joining me. I know that you're aware of the recent escape from the depot, and you made some comments on social media. I want to ask you, though, if we kind of step back a little bit and ask a very kind of commonplace question. The Rohingya, do we treat them differently from other refugees?
Yeah, thanks, Sharad, and good to be here. And can I just flip back to your intro and reframe it not as a problem of refugees? Because too often I think refugees and migrants are seen as problematic or a problem, but I think we want to reframe that and look at the broader spectrum of issues surrounding this. And some of them are, you know, from the government and from other parties. So to the question, are we treating or is Malaysia treating Rohingya refugees differently? I think it's important to note that Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention or the Protocol, so does not legally recognize refugees in any way or form. Therefore, refugees only exist as undocumented migrants in Malaysia under the Immigration Act. And so all refugees are treated somewhat equally in terms of the law, but not in the way they're policed or surveilled by the state. Rohingya are the largest refugee group in Malaysia. There's the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugee in Malaysia, registers refugees, and they've registered around 150,000, of which 100,000 are Rohingya. So they're the largest group, and that's underreported. I would say there are many more. In terms of their treatment, I think in Malaysia, Malaysia has always treated refugee groups quite differently. So if we look historically, Filipino Moro were given IMM-13 visas, work rights in Sabah for a number of years. Achinese refugees were given work rights and IMM-13 status. Cham refugees were in fact resettled from refugee camps to Malaysia. So Malaysia has a long history of treating different groups of refugees differently, depending on a number of factors. In terms of the Rohingya have been coming to Malaysia to seek sanctuary since the 1970s. So again, you've had different groups of Rohingya having very different experiences. So the earlier people coming in the 70s and 80s, integrated into Malaysian societies. In some, for some of them, they got legal status. Their children went to school. They're very embedded and integrated into Malaysian society. Equally, for some of the ones who came in the 90s, they achieved some kind of status. But I think since 2015, there was a rapid acceleration of refugees fleeing the violence, the genocide in Rakhine State. To Bangladesh and onwards to Malaysia, and that increased the numbers. So Rohingya weren't the largest refugee population in Malaysia for a long time, but that really changed dramatically over the last 10 years, especially since 2015.
Right. You have actually made an argument in an academic paper. You argue, and I quote you here, it says, the recent Malaysian history of refugee treatment presents a case for Muslim solidarity, but one tempered by a prevalent racism in Malaysia against people from the Indian subcontinent. Help us understand that.
Well, as I just mentioned, for instance, the Cham, who have a very long history, especially with Kelantan and Terengganu. So Cham used to come to the Malay courts to seek sanctuary when there were political issues in Cham State. And so they've been communities of Cham in Malaysia for a very long time. And there's been this exchange, and they share cultural and religious traits. which goes some way in explaining why Cham were accepted by Malaysia in the 70s when the Indochina War broke out, and when Cham were persecuted by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, that the Malaysian government went so far as to resettle them to Malaysia and provide them through Perkim with welfare for a number of years. And I think that is because there was a Muslim solidarity, but there was also a cultural affinity because Malaysians understood the Cham. They had ongoing relationships with Cham people that were enduring and longstanding. On the other hand, with refugees from Rohingya, I think there is a racist element to how Rohingya are being treated. Rohingya are often deemed to be Bangladeshi by both the Myanmar state, which is, you know, at the heart of the problem of them being stateless, but it also plays out in Malaysia when Malaysians identify or perceive Rohingya refugees as Bangladeshi migrant workers, with the associated racist attitudes many Malaysians have, unfortunately, against Bangladeshis or generally people from the subcontinent. And
Gareth, just to jump in there and say, when you present these views, and have you presented these views to Malaysian authorities, I mean, what is the response to your assertion that, underscoring this, because the Moro, you know, are Muslims, the Athenese are Muslims, Palestinians are Muslims, they're all Rohingya Muslims. You're saying that there's a racist dimension to this. I mean, what do they say to you when you present this view?
Well, most Malaysian authorities sadly don't listen to me, don't engage with my arguments on that level. But I think there is a broad understanding and acknowledgement that, in fact, most countries are quite racist, or people in most countries are racist. It's just that people direct their racism against different kinds of people. In Malaysia, I think Indians, Bangladeshis, you know, people with darker skin colors tend to be subjected to more racism than others. And we've seen that in the treatment of refugees. For instance, during the breakup of the Yugoslavia, Mahathir made a big deal out of saving a couple of hundred, you know, kind of white Muslims from Bosnia and giving them sanctuary, IMM-13 visas, and on the basis of Muslim solidarity, but there was a kind of a race element to that, that he could play on the international domain. I think that's another aspect, that the politics of it. Rohingya are generally not very politically connected. For instance, in Malaysia, the other largest group of refugees have been the Chin from Chin State in Myanmar. They have a huge diaspora in the US and are politically quite well connected. They're evangelical Christian, so they have good connections to American politicians, so much so that they could get American politicians in the early 2000s to come to Malaysia to argue with Malaysian authorities to provide Chin with better conditions, which they didn't get, but you know, Malaysian or the US offered a lot of Chin refugees visas and resettlement places to come to the US. So very successful, you know, to garner political support and then use that. And the Rohingya have been quite unsuccessful, sadly, in the international domain to garner that kind of commitment from different states to help them. And
this is very interesting because it's deeply ironic. You know, when you lay it out like that and comparing them to the Chin refugee community, there is another article that you wrote, a very poignant headline. It says, "There we are nothing, here we are nothing." And it's about the effects of the Rohingya genocide. And you say, and I'm going to quote you, you say, "The genocide process that began in Myanmar continues to play out in Malaysia and creates a compound effect on the lives of Rohingya refugees here." So, help us understand, because it's a very complex set of dynamics that you're laying out. How is it that the genocide process continues here?
Let me just start with a different example, and that I think is the kind of dimension of class that we often also don't really talk about when we talk about refugees. For instance, Syrian refugees have been given, again, visas, work rights under a specific government program. And, you know, essentially they come to Malaysia as skilled migrants with a lot of cultural capital. And again, Rohingya have been discriminated against, persecuted by their own government in Myanmar over decades, which means they don't have the education, they don't have the cultural capital, they don't have the financial capital to move often. And so they're stuck either in Myanmar, where they are confined to their villages or refugee camps, or Bangladesh, where they're confined to refugee camps. And the relatively few who make it out either to Malaysia or other places into the diaspora. There is a complete lack of that kind of cultural, educational capital that would allow them to go out and garner that political support I mentioned earlier that other groups are able to garner. And what happens to a lot of refugees who come to Malaysia, Rohingya refugees who come to Malaysia, is that they have to work and they want to integrate, and they usually pick up the Malay language very quickly, and they assimilate willingly often as much as they can to Malay society, because they, in their minds, they see Malaysia as an Islamic state, for better or for worse, because they think that finally they can practice their religion freely and openly, that they can't do in Myanmar, that they will be protected, physically at least, and that they will have some opportunities, either in terms of education or in terms of work. But that also means that they can't build up the cultural capital that they would need to have a strong Rohingya identity, because now they're assimilating into Malay identity, wearing Malay clothes, speaking Malay, trying to be as Malay as they can, and thereby negating their Rohingya identity. And that, in a way, is part of that ongoing genocidal process that is started in Myanmar, but plays out in displacement when they are curtailed. They continue to be curtailed intellectually, curtailed in terms of opportunities to be who they actually are.
Gerhard, that's wonderful. We'll take a short break now and we'll come back with more. Stay tuned to Consider This. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Sharad Kutum. I'm speaking to Gerhard Hofstadter, Associate Professor at the University of Queensland. And we're talking about the Rohingya community. And there's a larger refugee problem, or as Gerhard reminded me, it's really not, they're not the problem. It is, in fact, the structures in which they have to negotiate that present problems. And I want to ask you this, you have written about the ways in which especially the undocumented refugee, somebody who's an asylum seeker but hasn't got UNHCR protection, somebody who hasn't got the right to work here, tries to find a place in the city. Could you tell us a little bit about that invisibility, and what we've come to know about the vulnerabilities that in some ways we have heaped upon the Rohingya, and what consequence that seems to be having with the community at large?
Yes, thank you, Sharad. So if you'll allow me a short excursus on how I got to study refugees in the first place. I actually studied or worked with Malay young people initially, but often we would go out and we would be in spaces with other people and I would say, oh, who are these people? And my interlocutors would say, oh, I don't know, they're just migrant workers. And so I started thinking about, well, who are these people and what are their stories? And it turned out that many of these so-called migrant workers were in fact refugees. So if you go out for dinner, there are high chance in central KL that, the food is being cooked by a refugee. If you're driving along the motorway, the grass will have been cut by a refugee. So refugees are all around, you in KL and other parts of Malaysia. Some of them work in plantations. So I think it's part of that every day, but it's hidden. And so I wanted to not shine a light, but understand what was going on. And the issue of invisibility is twofold. On the one hand, invisibility is sought by most refugees because it provides them protection. So they don't want to be visible to the authorities because often authorities will ask them for bribes or will stop them. They could be detained. That's not something they want to happen. So they'd rather be invisible. And you see people hiding in plain sight, as it were, by trying to mask and kind of be part of a recognized group in Malaysia. As you know, if people can blend in and be a bit more like Malays in Malay neighborhoods, then that's being invisible. Or if you look more Chinese, then if you blend in a Chinese neighborhood and so on. So invisibility can act as a protection mechanism for many. But it also means that in the broader Malaysian society, the issue of refugees is not adequately discussed. And I think that's a huge problem, because if Malaysians aren't aware that refugees are underpinning, and many undocumented workers more generally are underpinning the Malaysian economy, then they don't recognize refugees as an integral part of society and an important part of society too. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Malaysia is not a signatory to the convention and protocol, the Refugee Convention, which means there's no legal protection for refugees. So I've been arguing for a long time that Malaysia should really recognize refugees in some form and provide them some legal standing so that refugees who are very willing and able and are already working in the economy could do so and pay taxes and could be part of society in a much more open and visible way and contribute to society, which also then means that Malaysians are much more aware of those contributions.
Gerhard, I mean, these arguments have been made to policymakers, to, you know, those in government for a long time. There is a hesitance, and I wonder if the resistance comes from something deeper. You studied Malaysian society. You understand the political dynamics here. These very rational arguments about, incorporating refugees as a whole, Rohingya in particular, into the workforce, as you say, a taxable workforce, giving them education so they contribute to society. All those very rational arguments seem to come up against a wall. What is that wall, Gerhard?
I think there are sadly a number of walls that have been erected. I think Malaysia has for a long time used the specter of humanitarianism to give selective protection to some people, and usually temporary protection, which means that they can turf people out. So Achenes, at the height of it, there were 30,000 Achenes on IMM-13 visas with work rights, educational rights for their children. But after a couple of years, when the Malaysian government decided they should go home, they kind of canceled those visas and sent most of them back to Aceh. So it's a matter of sovereignty and convenience for a government to be able to do that. Once you sign the convention, you have a more formalized framework. Usually the next question is, well, how do you formalize status? And then how do you integrate people into society and how can they stay? And I think in Malaysia, because of the demographic political games that continue to be played around the kind of major ethnic groups and the politics around that, Malay, Chinese, Indian, that has been sometimes used by the government. For instance, the Moro and the Project IC, infamously in Sabah, where many Moro were naturalized in effect, made Malaysian citizens, in fact, in many cases, which changed the demographics quite considerably in Sabah. And so there is that potential to do, the wrong thing politically which might work for a government at a particular point in time. As you say, the more rational argument would be to have an equitable framework where everyone has the same kind of access to this and it's not selective.
But if, as you say, the Rohingya themselves see assimilation into the majority community as the way to go, that's their own perspective on the dynamics. Wouldn't it then be beneficial? Though, I mean, the numbers must be rather small when you think about the overall electoral role. I mean, I don't know how impactful that could be. But if that was the logic, if assimilation is the logic and into the majority community, what is the problem for the state then, if it is there essentially to protect majority interests?
I think with the Rohingya, it's slightly different. I mean, as you say, electorally, it wouldn't make a huge dent in Peninsular Malaysia, perhaps. And I think there's also some nuance in terms of what I mentioned earlier, in terms of assimilation. So many Rohingya do try to assimilate to Malay society, but that's largely those Rohingya often who came earlier and who live in rural Peninsular Malaysia, in smaller communities where they might be the only Rohingya family. In neighborhoods where the Rohingya have become either, you know, the dominant group or a large minority, they do retain more of their uniqueness or their own cultural traits, which are sometimes seen as, or deemed hostile by people who live there. So we had some issues around Selayang Market a couple of years ago, and you know, the politics around others, foreigners, being in Malaysia and doing things, working, is often, again, used by the government in terms of being seen as a strong government, and governments all around the world do this. This is not a Malaysian trait, but immigration controls, detention, you know, in the Australian case, the externalization of the border. These are all mechanisms of governments to make themselves look strong to the electorate. And refugees often fall into that group of being, you know, hyper surveyed and detained and swept up in immigration raids, for instance.
Yeah, you point to something that happens on an almost annual basis, which is the hysteria over some part of the capital being occupied by foreigners, taken over by foreigners. That seems to be part of the kind of hysteria whipped up by some segments of the mainstream media. I do want to ask you, in the last couple of minutes that we have, what do you think is the long-term scenario that you see playing out? Recognizing the chasm between good practice and actual practice and the political dynamics that we have in Malaysia, what do you think is the fate of the Rohingya people in Malaysia?
Sadly, my predictions are usually pessimistic when it comes to Malaysia. I think the Rohingya in Malaysia at the moment will probably have to be there for a long time. Resettlement under COVID was restricted, so not many people left in general, and Rohingya often don't get the resettlement places that other groups do. So, you know, for Rohingya, Malaysia is actually the destination. They want to stay in Malaysia. I think for the Malaysian government, it would be really helpful for Malaysia to have more of a look at their own frameworks around refugees and to match up their rhetoric with their practice, because subsequent prime ministers have often used the Palestinian issue, the Rohingya issue, you know, as an emotive issue to come out and say, we have to help our brothers and sisters. My point would be, then please do. And, you know, around Ramadan, we often see there's some action, and then the rest of the year there isn't. So I think, you know, if the rhetoric would match the action, that would be of great benefit to many refugees in Malaysia. And if the Malaysian electorate could hold their elected politicians to their words that they often use, that would be a great step forward.
Yeah, okay, we have a little bit more time. What would you say to the Rohingya community? You meet with them, you talk to them, their sense of what's going on, and what would your what questions would you ask them as they try to negotiate this tricky situation?
I mean, all you know, when we talk about the Rohingya, it flattens internal dynamics. There are many different groups of people within the Rohingya community doing fantastic things. We support a football team, and there are several Rohingya football teams. So if you're interested in football, go out and watch them, support them. There are lots of community organizers and community groups who are doing great things. There's a very ambitious women's development network that's doing great work to empower women in the Rohingya community. So there's lots of good things happening, but again, it's not that visible. So if we could shine a light on some of those good examples of how the community is doing and what they're doing in Malaysia, rather than focusing on some negative aspects that often get focused on by the authorities.
Thank you so much, Gerhard. That was Gerhard Hofstadter. He's Associate Professor at the School of Social Sciences, University of Queensland, author of Modern Muslim Identities, Negotiating Religion and Ethnicity in Malaysia. That's all we have for you on Consider This. I'm Sharad Putin, signing off with you. Good night. We'll be right back.